situation we have in Fifth Alma here. Both Alma and his father had been having a constant struggle, as you know, to keep the Nephites in the path of duty. They're always drifting away, as Israel does. Could they be to blame? Were they too severe? You notice both of them are over strict. You know, in the first place, Alma Sr. actually made his own son rebellious. And same thing with Mosiah. Perhaps they were being too strict. The kids went off and they went overboard. Remember when he started, when he founded the church, when he ran away from King Noah and went out and founded it on the teachings of Abinadi. You know what kind of a fire eater Abinadi was? It was very strict. It was the strict, austere brotherhood of Qumran, or it was nothing. And he always insisted that that's the way the church would be. And he no sooner got the church started in cooperation with Mosiah, and what happened? People start drifting away in large numbers, as a matter of fact. Going out, first it was in the outskirts, different settlements with which he wasn't too often in contact, and he didn't even know what was going on. What kind of a leader is this? And people, I say, were becoming disaffected in large numbers, and it got worse and worse, and they started walking out in droves. And then Nehor put himself at the head of this movement. He took advantage of it for a more easygoing, a more relaxed, a more permissive church. That's what he wanted, which became popular and which remained the more popular church. But must the church be that strict? Probably must. Then we see next, Amalekai capitalized on that. He wanted to go to the other extreme and, with a disaffected group, formed a party to make him king. Wasn't quite strong enough, but it was a very serious threat. We see that. Alma was able to check it and overcome him in a hand-to-hand combat, you see. But does it went back to normal? No, they didn't go back to normal. That's where we get here. Here in this chapter, he decides on a general reformation. And this is a long chapter. These next two chapters, the next he goes out to the outskirts. The next two chapters after that, see, he goes to the people of Gideon, and then he goes to the people of Melech, Monihah, and tries to do the same thing. He's refounding the order of things to establish it exactly in the pattern as was done in the first. It's the law of Moses he's following, as we read later on, very strictly. It was strictly the law of Moses. So he celebrated the covenant just exactly as Benjamin did in a great renewal, in a great coronation, at the coronation, right? Renewing the covenant, renewing the state, the society, and the creation of the world. And this is one of the best known phenomena of ancient history now. It wasn't a few years ago, but I've been yelling about it for years. As is well known, this is a stock theme. It's the rehearsing of the creation, the refounding, the rebirth of the human race. It's the Natalia. It is the refounding of the kingdom. It's universal. Everyone is reborn, receives a new name, and so forth on a particular day, which, of course, is the new year. It's gauged by the sun and so forth. Now, it's very conspicuous in the documents. And only within the last 3 or 4 years, the anthropologists have latched onto it. Finally, when they catch up to it, it's become very obvious. You can see that. And this is a very basic theme. I notice the three principal anthropologists writing about this now, they've all got into the act. There's Van Gennep's theory that society, and this talks about their anthropologists. See, they're talking about primitive societies. This is universal. Van Gennep's theory is that society has to regenerate itself by rites of passage. You know what a rite of passage is, the rite de passage, a rite of passage into the other world, and then you have to get passage to come back. That's what they're talking about now. There are two worlds. You go to the one, and then you come back refreshed and renewed to your old world and begin a new cycle of life. This is what they're saying today. Well, it's been obvious for 100 years, but they didn't notice that they've been following Fraser instead. A very different pattern here around the king. Well, Van Gennep's theory is regeneration by rites of passage. He says it sometimes takes the form of rites of death and rebirth. And Victor Turner, he says the rites all apply to the society, don't affect the individual at all. It's just the society first separates itself from its former life. That is what you do, you see, when you drive out the scapegoat and so forth. You purge yourself of what you were before. It separates themselves from their former life. And then there's what he calls the transition. And then there's the reincorporation, when you come back to ordinary life and you're good for a new period and so forth. And Edmund Leach, finally, who's the third one, he says, each festival shifts from the ordinary community to the sacred order and back again. It's sacralization. Separation from the secular, from this world, there's transition, and then there is what he calls marginal time. It's all term of time. You go into another time. You go into marginal time, and that's your transition. and then you come back again to desacralization, the aggregation as a new beginning of secular time. Well, they like to use all this gobbledygook and so forth. It's been staring us in the face for 100 years, and finally they made it as a great discovery. So they like to theorize and so forth. It's funny because they're dealing with the most, supposedly with the most simple, primitive people, to which they feel vastly superior, but who are vastly superior to them, as the recent work of, don't let me say what's his name again. must not get into that habit. But Levi Strauss, the famous anthropologist, oh, it's 15 years ago now that he wrote his revolutionary work on primitive mind. They weren't primitive at all. He says they know an awful lot more than the anthropologists come to study them, and it's true, they do. The anthropologists didn't know that. He's always taken, see, I used to share, for 4 years, I shared an office with Morris Opler, who is the president of the American Archaeological Association. Every Thursday, Hoyer would come out from, they were Indian men, Hoyer would come out from UCLA, and we'd listen to records and we'd talk about this sort of thing. Well, anyway, the anthropologists take the Aristotle's point of view that the observer is always superior to the observed, you see. If I'm looking at a bug or a leaf or something like that naturally, I'm superior. And if I study you as an anthropologist, then I am the superior mind, and I'm viewing an inferior object, you see, because I have you in my power, so you are whatever I say you are. It's enormous vanity of these. That Chicago school, Ruthie Benedict and those people. We won't go into that. That was a, year, that was a four-year time, fortunately. But this, what makes the theories different from the golden bough of Fraser, as I say before, was the fundamental idea of two worlds, and that's what they all recognize, that you go to the other world and then you come back to this world. Two worlds. Of course, the Hopis have the four worlds, but it's just the other world and this world. And I have been, a Jewish girl who's very good, she's an anthropologist, Abu Zahra, Nadia Abu Zahra. She finds the idea of, she's made a study of basic rain rituals all the way, but especially in North Africa, where she's familiar in Morocco, all the way from Morocco to Afghanistan, you find rain is the main subject because it's desert country, you see. And their rites are very elaborate and so forth, but absolutely identical with the Hopis. You never notice, but that's true. They go through the very same sort of thing. But it has to do with this fundamental idea of two worlds, and it's nowhere better expressed than in the Quran. The Arabs have a marvelous idea about this. There is the Alam al-Shahada and the Alam al-Ghazla. Well, al-Ghaib, the Alam al-Ghaib. I don't know why I should write these on the board, but Shahada. Now, this is a very rich word. Shahada. Don't count me to be sober Monday mornings. And the other, of course, is Ghaib. Well, might as well write it out. Alam. Alam. It has to be, can't be Al Shahada, it has to be Ashahada, but that's all right. And the Alam. Alam, the world of Al-Ghaib. Shahada, they're both very rich roots, and they both mean the same thing. And this is very true. This, Alam al-Shahada, the word Shahada means to be present. The Shahadatun is a witness. A Shahadat is a evidence. A Shahada is a testimony. Shahada is to behold, to witness personally. But Shahada, the basic meaning is to be present on the scene and see what's going on. Shahada. So the Alam al-Shahada is the world to which you can bear testimony by your own personal experience. You can only bear testimony to so much, no more, no less, but what you've experienced, that's the real. Naturally, you assume that's the only world. But then there is the Alam al-Ghaib. You find all words in Arabic that begin with ghaib have to do with the covering. You say ghaib alai, he means he passed out, he fainted, there was a, literally, it means there was a covering over him. And the Alam al-Ghaib is the world which is behind the veil. See, ghaib is, the basic word ghaib is to be absent, not to be there. See, this means to be present and know what's going on. This is to be both absent and not know, because it means confusion, it means vagueness, it means dimness, it means the other world, it means the other side, it means something beyond our ken. They call it the infinite world, the vast world, the world that's unknown to us. The Egyptians put it very nicely. Their word for everything is nenti yuti, all that which is and all that which is not, you see. All that which is, all that I know about, but if I'm going to include everything, it has to include a lot of things I don't know, because it's just possible it's something I don't know that exists, you see. And of course, the yuti, the part that you don't know about, is vastly greater than the other. Now, the world that God knows about and the world that you know about, this is the world as God knows it, the world as you know, are two totally different things. You know that, you see. So we're living in the Alam al-Shahada, and reality would be the Alam al-Ghaib. And the purpose of these festivals, you see, that they all have these festivals, and this is true in Islam too, is to, that's what the, what our temple does, you see. You get a peep behind the veil. You go into the other world. You try to make yourself intimate. You ease yourself into a vaster life and nearer to reality. That's all what physics is trying to do today. It's getting so far out now. You've heard of this new Higgs boson, haven't you? You've heard of Peter Higgs, his boson. Everybody's looking for it. They're spending hundreds of millions of dollars in Europe and here. Stanford is competing with CERN on it, they tell me, and so forth, trying to discover the Higgs boson. It's namely this. After all the particles are considered, everything else, there is one vast enclosing essence or particle or whatever it is, field, it's one field, that accounts for everything. Its force produces all the particles, whatever the other particles are. If you can only get the Higgs boson, because Peter Higgs in Edinburgh suggested he didn't discover it. They're looking for it, and they're spending hundreds of million dollars to discover that ultimate particle. It's an ultimate field of force, an ultimate world that will be the real one that will explain all the others. And they say, well, in a few years, we'll know everything. They've said that before, see. It's exactly what we have here. When we go, when you go to Mecca, or when you go to the temple, or and one time we had, remember we had to teach the Book of Mormon here to everybody. Oh, no, not the Book of Mormon, the religion being BYU. And when President Harris first went, President Harris established the four-point program, you see, for bringing Near Eastern students over here. So we got a flood of Muslim students here at BYU in the 40s and 50s. And they had to take religion, so they take Book of Mormon. And I taught the Book of Mormon class. That was the only one, you see. And we had them there. And in one class, I had nine students from Mecca. They had been brought here by a tawaf. A tawaf is a person who accompanies you through. He's your paralemptor. When you go through the temples or when you go through the rites, you have somebody standing at your elbow telling you to give the right answers and what to do so you won't make any mistakes. See? And he was a tawaf from Mecca and knew all that, and he was so excited about the gospel and he brought all these friends from Mecca, of all things. The thing that surprised me more than anything else was none of them had ever seen a camel. Now, anybody from Egypt or from Palestine has seen camels all over the place, but these people from Mecca had never seen camels. Isn't that amazing? Well, that's another story, of course. But no, we're talking about the same thing here. We're all in the same boat here, and it's a very interesting thing. And so the Quran expresses it well in this here. And so this is what you have in these four chapters, 5, 6, and 7 here, have to do with the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. We saw it, Kippur. Well, Professor Popper used to use it. That's the way the Jews explain today, Kippur, cover. It means the covering of your sins, the day of covering. But there's Yom Kippur, which is a rededication. It's the Day of Atonement. See, Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement, at one with, becoming one with God again. We've been separated from God. We've been cast out. We have sinned and so forth, the fall in the garden. We must get back again into the presence of God, and that is at one with, which you write Atonement. It surprises people to know that Atonement is not a Latin or Greek word. It is a genuine old English word. It means just what it says, at one with. It's been replaced now in the Bible by reconciliation, as mentioned before, which means come back to a person and sit down with him again. And so we have that. We have the these rededications, we have them everywhere. Therefore, 10 days, for example, before Yom Kippur, every night you have to go, if you're pious enough, you go to the mosque, you go to the synagogue, and you pray the Salikos prayer at midnight, which is a prayer of repentance. You repent for the 10 days receding. It's a great time of repentance and change, so you can go back and be reunited with God at Yom Kippur. And then the oldest Egyptian document we have is the Shavako stone. When the 25th dynasty was founded, either by Shabako or by Kashtu, but Shabako is responsible for this one, the stone, he renovated the temple of Menes, which was built to celebrate the first founding, the first founding of Egypt, the first dynasty, which represented the founding of the world and creation. It's the creation story, the drama, Adam and Eve in the garden, the outcasting, the processes, the ordinances by which you return to the presence of God, and finally the veil, all through the rest of them. Well, this is in this, the Shabako stone. We often refer to it in classes because it's come in for a lot of recent study. Shabako, who was the king, he was an Ethiopian who founded the 25th dynasty, and he wanted to get off his dynasty in style. Every new dynasty, there were 31 of them, every new dynasty had to be a refounding of the world. In fact, this says in the beginning at the top, see, this was when they were renovating the temple, this is necessary to show the universality of these things, so forgive me. When they were renovating the temple, it's like when they were renovating the Nauvoo house, they found the text of the Book of Mormon, Oliver Cowdery text, in the cornerstone. And this was found in the cornerstone of the temple of Menes going way back 5,000 years ago. And what would be better than to use this for the temple drama? The creation story, this is what they wanted. And so he says at the top, he caused it to be copied and so forth, that everything now is going to be done exactly as it was then, only he says, only as it began to, nefer er emche, but better than it was before. We're going to do everything anew en mawet, but everything nefer er emche, better than it was before. So they go through and rehearse all this stuff. And in Rome, you had the Restitutio Orbis, the restitution of the universe, of the world. Really, the Orbis is the Urbs, the city. But the Orbis, it represents the world, just as the temple does at Jerusalem. And in 274, when things were badly run down, the Emperor Redon wanted to turn everything around, his great conquest in the Near East and so forth. So he celebrated the Restitutio Orbis, everything being made new and fresh and so forth. Though that's supposed to happen every new year anyway, the festival of Janus and so forth. And the Greeks called it the Eniautos. Here we are again. We have come full circle. And of course, our ancestors call it the Yule, the celebration. This is what they're having. The Yom Kippur is the Yule, which is just the word wheel. Both the Old English as well that's the Yule. It's a wheel. It goes around and around. Of course, in Arabic, the word is hawala. Hawala, haveil. Norbert Wiener's father, has written extensively on this, and the Grimm's also. So when in Arabic it says hawal hawala, means the wheel turned a complete turning. We're back where we started, and we say the wheel is the Yule, and of course they roll wheels down the hill and do all sorts of things with wheels at the Yule. The Yule is where you complete the circle and you come back again. That's what it means. So we get this completion of the circle and so forth. And that's what we're going to have here. We're going to have a refounding. Every Day of Atonement is supposed to be this. So notice how it starts out. He emphasizes, in verses like the first verse, it's the first. These are the words with which he established. Notice the formal rite he's talking about, the second verse. These are the words with which he established it. And then the next verse, he says, he began to establish the church, beginning with an ordinance, baptism, says here. Because before you enter temple, you're washed. And behold, I say unto you, they were delivered out of the hands of King Normandy, and he gives them a history of their bondage and so forth, brought to this land again, five, to establish the church. He's introducing everything anew here, and he's reestablishing. There must be a stirring below. Do you remember the captivity of your fathers and so forth? This is so very interesting because the first Dead Sea Scrolls discovered was the Sirach Scroll, the Manual of Discipline, their Doctrine and Covenants, which told exactly why they were out there and what they were doing. It begins right like this. On the first day, all the candidates for the ordinance and so forth will meet together in a meeting, and the first thing, and they're told how their fathers were led out of Egypt and their sufferings and all they went through and how they've been delivered. Exactly this speech that he gives here as the Sirach Scroll. So I'll write in margin IQS here, the Sirach Scroll. Have you sufficiently retained in remembrance that you delivered your souls? He changed their hearts. See, we're going into a new life here. It's going to be a rebirth. He's going to say that here. They were in the midst of darkness. They've been illuminated by light. I said before that goes back to the mysteries, but the mysteries are very secondary here. This is always the festival of light. Remember, it's always held at sunrise and so forth. It's the rising of the sun in the new year. Of course, you date it by that. See, when the sun comes up, you're in a new age, a new cycle has begun, and the sun has come again. They changed their hearts out of the midst of darkness, illuminated by the light. They were encircled around by the bands of death and the chains of hell. Now, those encircling, instead, they're going to be encircled, as we said, by the Kippurah, by the arms of God when he welcomes them into the tent after he's parted the veil. And the priest says, they have passed the test, they have purified themselves, they have repented, and so forth. Then he says, let Israel enter my presence, and they come into the tent, into the Kippurah. The Kippurah is the veil that departs the tent. Notice the bands of death are broken, the chains of hell which encircle. Notice he keeps talking about this encircling. Encircled by the bands of death, encircled by the chains of hell. Their souls did expand, and they did sing redeeming love. Now here we have the song of redeeming love. This is a very interesting thing. And remember, these rites were last performed in Lehi's generation. After that, Jerusalem was destroyed, you know. Well, it was rebuilt again, but they never restored these rites again. This is where you would have, Good Book of Mormon is where you have to go for the old rites the way they were performed. And this is the way they were, we find them in the Law of Moses, too. So he says here, their souls did sing, and he's going to mention the song of redeeming love a little later here. It's an interesting thing. I ask of you, on what conditions are you saved? Are you ready? Are you ready to enter? Remember, this parallels Benjamin's speech, which is given at the New Year. The people have all come to the temple. They're camping, as they should, with their tents facing the temple. And we don't get this from the Bible. We get this from Nathan the Babylonian, who was present at a coronation of the Prince of the Captivity many years after the destruction of Jerusalem. But he describes exactly how it used to be carried out, and of course that's what we find in Mosiah. Now here's another repetition. He's refounding, he's desperate, he's going to establish everything all over again, and the Jews are used to this business of getting a new start. And so I ask of you, on what conditions are you saved? What is the cause of their being loosed from the bands of death and the chains of hell? There he goes again, you see. We're in the darkness. It's this. First, you have to believe in the words, and he asks them, did he not speak the words of God? My father Alma believed them. Alma began, the whole motion began when, whole movement began when Alma started to believe the words of Abinadi. The next one, according to the faith, there was a mighty change wrought in their heart. And thirdly, he preached unto your fathers and moved them. His heart was changed, and then he changed others. He's giving a lot of credit to his father here. Now, we said it was the birthday. Oh, the Romans give us, it's a universal day. The same thing in Egypt, for example. Everybody who is born on the same day as the Pharaoh has a birthday will identify with him. He can go live in the palace or anything like that. But in places like Rome, everybody dates his, well, in Egypt, everybody dates his own birthday, not from the day he was born, but from the day the Pharaoh assumed the throne. That was the beginning of years. But of course, we call it in the Western world, we call it the Natalia, the great birthday. Natalia, everybody is born. That's the Saturnalia when everybody celebrates and so forth. Well, we go on here, so here it is, you see. You have been spiritually born of God. See, this is your birthday. You have been now spiritually born. Have you received his image in your countenance? Now, you notice this chapter and the next, but especially this one, is extremely rich in the most powerful imagery of the atonement rites, are full of vivid imagery. He mixes them very freely, and the people understand what he means, and this is very characteristic. And so he starts out with this image here, and see what happens now. You look forward with the eye of faith. See, there is a metaphor, there is an image. To stand before God to be judged, another image. But it's more than an image, it's a reality in the future, because now he starts talking about imagination. Notice in the 16th verse, I say unto you, can you imagine you hear the voice of God? 17th verse, he says, do you imagine yourself that you can lie unto God? The 18th verse, he begins, otherwise, can you imagine yourselves brought before the tribunal? Notice each verse begins with the word imagine. Can you imagine this? No, progressively, you imagine. Well, is it legitimate to imagine? Are you cheating if you imagine too much? Is all that we have of the gospel, is this just imagination? Are we just making it up? You see, we think it's very real to us. And these are the stations, you know. You can imagine you hear the voice of the Lord. Now, before you can carry out any operation, you notice this, you must visualize it. You must imagine it, but no matter what it's going to be. So there's nothing wrong with imagining things. You have to. What about history? Where does history exist? 100% in imagination. Did I read you out of Stephen Hawking's book on that? I should have brought that along. I'll bring it the next time. It's very good on that. He says, there's nothing in science, nothing else. It's just pure imagination, nothing else. He says, you'll never be able to prove any of this. It's just a structure of your own mind. He feels it very strongly. In his condition, one would, I suppose. Imagine that you hear the voice of the Lord that day saying, come unto me and be blessed, for behold, your works have been the works of righteousness. That would be wonderful. Or imagine yourselves that you can lie unto the Lord on that day and say, Lord, our works have been righteous, and that he'll save you, he'll believe you. No, you can't do that. The first alternative is to be righteous. The second is to try to bluff it and say you were righteous. The third, can you imagine yourself brought before the tribunal of God, your souls filled with guilt and remorse, having a remembrance of all your guilt and a perfect remembrance of all your wickedness. Very vivid. You can imagine that. You can imagine it right now, he says. You do have a remembrance of your guilt, as far as that goes. And it'll come back more quickly, of course, in the presence of God. I say unto you, you can look up to God on that day, another again, 19th verse, having the image of God. Notice he starts out, have you received the image in your countenance? Now he says, can you look up, having the image of God engraven upon your countenance? The same thing he began with. In other words, this is a real at-one-ment when you're united with God, and like the Father and the Son, exactly alike. A perfect correspondence here. It's not an unio mystica or anything like that. Become exactly alike. Of course, the problem arises if everybody looks exactly alike. We have a model of perfection, actually. Well, we don't, really. Is it blonde? Is it brunette? When you have a beauty contest, what are the rules you have to follow? What is it that the girl that wins, she has something that the others don't have? It's not measurements. I mean, you can measure with a caliper till the cows come home, and you're not going to establish beauty that way, are you? But what is it that we... if you all look alike, then, if there is a standard, I mean, I'd like to be much taller than I am, for example. That'd be nice, but I don't need to be. It doesn't break my heart or anything like that. Around here, everybody's tall, so there's nothing to be proud of anymore. When I walk down the street in Athens, I feel great because I'm as tall as anybody, but then I cross the border into Yugoslavia and I'm a runt. I feel terrible, so I better get back to Athens. But that's the way it is. Well, what is it then? We all wear the same basic white? What could be simpler than it wasn't the clothing here in Moroni? I was dressed in nothing but a white slipper. That's it. That's the whole thing. Yeah. Jonah says very clearly, you could see that that was all. Didn't need any more. He didn't need the protective garment. He's not in this wicked world. He's not in this dangerous place. But what's the difference? Well, you notice as people excel in certain things, they get to be more alike and more different. You take the greatest scientists or the greatest composers, the greatest painters. Composers are usually the best to deal with, you see. You get Bach, that's about as far as you could go, you see. There's perfection. But then Brahms comes along. Beethoven, rather, comes along, the man who liberates music, supposedly. And he's great, too, very much like... He shares Bach's grandeur and greatness. But a totally different idiom. Bach would never have written like that, and he never would have written like that. Then along comes Brahms. He's not a bit like the other two, but he has that same stature, that same greatness goes with it, that element of sublimity. We have a very interesting book on Brahms and that, how very religious, how deeply he prayed before he ever composed anything like that. But here you have, and Bach the same thing, they were all deeply religious, those men, you see, it was moving. The point is, as they become more alike in stature, they become more different in nature. So the great ones never found a school. There's not a school of Bach, a school of Beethoven, but you get minor composers I was going to say Bellini, the variations. Well, anyway, there are plenty of minor composers you can think of that found schools. And I was thinking of Gluck, but Gluck is too great, too. He wouldn't, it's not a school. There was a big, Rinuccini, he would be a good example. But as you become more enlightened and more, you become more yourself. You become absolutely more unique. It's an amazing thing. The Father and the Son, they look so alike you can't tell the difference between them. They look alike exactly and so forth, and yet we don't know what about them. But no, in our case, you see, this greatness. And of course, there's no room for jealousy, because why should the Father be jealous of the Son? The Son jealous of the Father. I mean, greatness recognizes and glories in greatness. You love to see someone that can do better than you can. That's the way it should be done. That's a thrilling thing, instead of the petty envy and so forth. In these science books, how there's jealous rivalry between, there's half a dozen Nobel Prize winners with a difference of 10 or 15 minutes between who gets the Nobel Prize and who's forgotten forever. The one that phoned his findings in first. This happened in more than one occasion. But here we go. He's talking about this. He says, come into, then he's, I say, this is a very rich image. You can imagine these things, and then he says, no man can be saved except his garments are washed white. Yes, his garments must be purified until they are cleansed from all stain through the blood of him who has been spoken of the Father. Now, there is a strange paradox here that you get. Washed in the blood of the Lamb. Have your garments been washed white in his blood? Well, how can blood wash garments white is the point, you see. If you ever attend a kosher slaughter, you know that the priest has to wear his priestly robes, the rabbi, though he does not have authority, he does not have no Kohen or Levite can establish his priesthood today. They don't have the genealogy. But still, he puts on the robes, and then when he cuts the throat of the beast, he becomes completely spattered with blood. There's no way of avoiding it, because it has to be hung upside down. All the blood has to run out, and when he makes that first cut, there's a terrific spurt of blood, and he always gets spattered. And then after they perform this rite and slain the Paschal Lamb, then Aaron and his sons appear before the people with their garments splattered with blood, which shows that the atonement has been made. The blood has been shed, you see, after the similitude. That means that the people's own blood has been washed white. Now, this is explained here, why, how blood can wash you clean here, because he's going to tell us here. Notice, the blood, your garments are stained with filth. They're bloody. That's the blood that's washed off, but their blood, notice the difference here. Cleansed from all stain through the blood of the Lamb, where the next verse says, I ask you, how will any of you feel while you stand before God, having your garments, not cleansed, you, having your garments stained with the blood and all manner of filthiness. So we have two kinds of stained garments. The one is your own. Your own, the blood and filthiness that stains your own garment. He says, it will testify against you. See, this is what the blood testifies against you here. We are guilty of what we assent to. We may not have shed very much blood, but we are all guilty of what we assent to. We all pay the same half shekel. It's a very interesting thing. Everybody must pay a sin tax, a tax for sin, on the Day of Atonement. But the interesting point is, you don't know how to evaluate sin, who is more guilty than the other. There's no way of knowing that, how guilty a person really is. So everybody must pay, whether it's a child, woman, child, rich, poor, makes no difference. Everyone must pay exactly the same amount, because only God knows who the real sinners are and who the others. So everyone pays the half shekel. Everybody has sinned some, I'll grant you that. Everyone must pay a half shekel, not more and not less. Now that puts us on an equal footing. But as far as giving an appraisal value to sins, we can't do that like the Jesuits did in their casuistry. That's not their casuistry. In probabilism, the doctrine of probabilism, we won't go into that now. But he says here, they wash white through the blood of the Lamb, and this is it, you see. This reminds you of the two serpents. Remember, in the wilderness, the people were bitten by serpents and were dying. They were stinging serpents. So Moses raised a serpent, a bronze serpent, on a staff, and all who looked upon the serpent can live. Well, the serpent heals the serpent. Did you notice on the staff of a physician, on the caduceus, the medical staff has two serpents intertwined. We're told that Hermes, who was the founder of the medical profession, the Greeks tell us, and that was the Imhotep of Egypt and so forth, Hermes, the Egyptian Hermes Thoth. Well, the two serpents are both copulating serpents because they beget, but they are also opposing each other. The one heals, the other kills. The one kills, the other heals. You see, the two must be intertwined because it must be the coincidence oppositorum that brings things to a balance, a gleichgewicht. So you have the two serpents, the serpent in the wilderness. As they were killed by the serpent, so they were healed by the serpent. We're told the same thing about the hyssop. And here's the same thing. As they got the blood and filth on their garments, so by the blood on the priest of the garments. Notice it says the blood on their garments testifies. Now, when we're told in Leviticus, Deuteronomy, that when the priest and his sons come out, having performed the sacrifice, their garments are spattered with this blood. That blood testifies that the sacrifice has been made and the other garments are washed clean. You see, the other blood is off them. So there's no contradiction in having garments washed clean by the blood of the Lamb. It testifies that they have been cleansed. Of course, we say this is all symbolic, but these symbols are very real with these people. If you have 208 here. Yes, 5 and 21. It's the Lamb's blood on the garment of the high priest that makes your garment white. So that's what he's talking about here. But notice this rich symbolism. It will testify against you. We can't apportion guilt. Just we're all guilty, you see. We must all be purified. All our lives we have to report. Notice again he says in the next verse, behold, will they not testify that you are murderers? Remember, carnal, sensual, and devilish. Also that you are guilty of all manner of wickedness? Well, we are. Behold, my brethren, now we come to the yeshuva and the yeshiva. And here is the yeshiva, you see. Suppose such a one, you see, you have to have your garments cleansed before you can come into the tent and sit down. That's what the priest testifies. We've done the rites. So he says, now you can come in, but you have to be cleansed. And notice that's what he talks about here. Behold, my brethren, do you suppose that such a one can have a place to sit down in the kingdom with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose garments are cleansed, spotless, and pure white? See, you have to cleanse your garments before you can come into the tent and sit down. As I say, it's called the yeshiva, a very important part of the Yom Kippur, the sitting down by the side of God. That's why it's translated now in the New King James, not King James Version, in the New Revised Version as reconciliation, reconcilio. The Latin was spelled originally with S, you see. Re means again, con means with, cilio, cedera means to sit down again with. Reconcilio means sitting down like a council and so forth, conciliate and giving counsel. But so you then can come in the tent and sit down with it. We saw that was in Nephi used that expression. He comes into the tent of the Lord when he's fleeing for his enemies and asks for the Lord to protect him, put his garment over his shoulder. And that's what happens there. And then he goes on here. I say unto you, except you may, we make our Creator a liar from the beginning. Do you suppose that you cannot suppose you cannot suppose that such shall have place? That's the other expression. Notice, you will sit down, which is Ahlan Masahlan, you shall have place. Marhaban is the wide place. That you can have place in the kingdom of heaven. No, this is the opposite of atonement, is to be cast out, to be rejected. You shall be cast out, for they are the children of the kingdom of the devil. You cast out into that other kingdom here. And remember this have place when Nephi grabs Zoram and holds him tight. He says to him, come down to my father's tent and you can have place with us. You can be members of the family and you're in. And if you're not, if you're rejected, this is what happens. You're cast out into the outer darkness, into the desert night, and because you're children of the kingdom of the devil. Now the 26th verse, he goes on here. And now behold, I say unto you, my brethren, if ye have experienced a change of heart, if ye have felt to sing the song of redeeming love, I would ask, can you feel so now? Now, this song of redeeming love, there's something interesting, because I see this is not found. This is found elsewhere, but it's found in the, archaeologists found it in the, where we got this now, the redeeming love, yeah. The oldest known synagogue is the ruin of Dura Europus. We almost know about Dura Europus, discovered in 1932. At Dura Europus, Dura Europus, is the ruin of Dura. It's been preserved perfectly by the sand since 256 AD, when it was destroyed and covered up. And the focal point of the assembly hall was a niche. Oh, I should have brought a book along, it had an illustration of that. Was a niche, which was originally behind the veil, you see. But of course, when they didn't have the veil of that, it was the Torah scroll, which is behind the veil. That is the synagogue equivalent of the Holy of Holies. Immediately above the niche was painted a great tree, we're quoting here the Jewish archaeologist, a great tree rising nearing to the ceiling, a vine tree without grapes. There is a table and a cup. Of course, this is the vine in the Book of Mormon. According to the Jewish scholars, the tree led to the great throne above, under the high ceiling. On the panel, immediately above the niche, on one side of the tree is depicted the great sacrifice, the sacrifice of Isaac the Akedah, because Isaac permitted himself to be sacrificed. See, that Akedah means the binding. He allowed himself to be bound. Therefore, that was an atoning sacrifice. The Akedah for the Day of Atonement. On the other side, we see Jacob blessing his 12 sons. Some lions have been painted over to accommodate the picture, but there are animals in it. Another panel shows Joseph blessing Ephraim and Manasseh in the presence of Jacob. So we're getting all these Book of Mormon motives and things. Along with the Old Testament figures, we see felines and masks of Dionysus and fertility symbols of Demeter. Well, what are Dionysus and Demeter doing there? They have to be there. In the midst of the tree are mingled various birds and animals. Above them, there sits Orpheus, very conspicuously playing his harp. His music brings all things into love and harmony, as you know, if you're thinking of Gluck's Orpheus, a gorgeous work. Oh boy, it thrills you. Midst of the tree mingled with various birds and animals. There above them sits Orpheus playing his harp. His music brings all things into love and harmony. That's the business of Orpheus. The Jewish scholars suggest he may represent David here, who saved Israel through his music. Music is certainly the theme. Every figure in the elaborate display is facing the viewer full face. They seem to have their mouths open, for they are all singing together. The Orphic motives are found in other synagogues as well. But how does this pagan theme of Orpheus relate to the Day of Atonement? The connection is found in the Hebrew word for the kaporet, the mercy seat, the Day of Atonement. In Greek, both the Old Testament, Septuagint, and the New, the kaporet is called the hilasterion, the place of the hilaria. It's called, both in Greek and Latin, it's called the hilasterion. That is the tent that the priest goes up to and where the veil is parted and so forth. But it's called in the New Testament and all the Greek translations, but of all things, by this word, hilasterion. That's the place where the hilaria is held. And our word hilarious comes from that, actually. And the hilaria. The hilasterion is a word used by Paul for atonement, actually, in the only reference in his reference addressed to the Romans. They're the ones that understand it. 3:27, since the Romans would understand it. The Roman writer Macrobius in the Saturnalia, see, the Saturnalia is the time. That's the great celebration. Saturnalia is the equivalent of the Day of Atonement. That's the equivalent of the Yom Kippur for the Romans, and it's very old. It goes back to archaic times. And there he tells us at the spring equinox to celebrate the revival of life with a new vegetation year, all life is renewed, the Dea Mater, the great mother, goddess, and Attis preside. He says the very figures we find at Dura Europus, and you find Dura Europus and Demeter at, and Dionysus, her son, or Attis Dionysus, at Dura Europus in the other synagogues. Why do they put these pagan figures mixed? Because it's the Hellasterian here. He says the very figures we find at Dura Europus and Dionysus and Demeter. The latter are drawn by her lions. Another Roman tells us that on that occasion Orpheus was regarded as the king of the primum regnum, the primal god creator, first king, ruler, begetter of the human family, and so forth. The Hilaria was the occasion on which all the world joined in the great creation hymn, as they burst into a spontaneous song of praise recalling the first creation. See, that's where our word, it means creation hymn. The word poem, Latin, Greek poema, means the creation hymn. Walter Otto has written a book on the subject called Die Musen. Walter Otto's book, and this hymn, the muses at the beginning and founding of the world, each one representing one department of knowledge and the universe, and matter and so forth. They all sing together the great creation hymn, which you find about in Job, when the sons of God shouted for joy, morning stars sang together. That's the creation hymn. You find it everywhere. It's very important. So the Hilaria was the occasion on which all the world joined the great creation hymn, where they burst into a spontaneous song of praise, recalling the first creation, as I say, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. That song of creation has left its mark throughout the literature of the ancient world everywhere. Now, the mingling of pagan with Jewish symbols in the early art, notice how rich. Alma doesn't draw back of the most sumptuous symbolism here. He just throws it all over the place, and it's to be accepted at face value, too. Some of it literal, and what isn't. So he says, the mingling of pagan with Christian symbols in the early art of the synagogue and church, very common, was long discounted as purely decorative. The Jews just put this in just for decorative purposes. Well, why would they bring these pagan symbols right into the synagogue just to decorate it? Not at all, of course. The explanation was soon discredited by the evidence, as Goodenough tells us. As Goodenough sees it, he says, Dura represented its Old Testament scenes clustered about the grapevine over the Torah shrine, a vine in which Orpheus played his lyre to the animals, while numerous other pagan symbols appeared in various parts of the room. The two, the pagan symbols and the Old Testament illustrations, could not be separated, and they can't be separated in Alma either. Well, now, here is some stuff I just added here. The Apostolic Constitutions is, if not the oldest, is the earliest Christian, one of the earliest Christian writings to appear after the days of the apostles. It mingles early Jewish and Christian formulas, Jewish Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, with strong predominance of the Jewish. Here the bishop leads the congregation in the liturgy, praising the Creator, the Savior, rich in love, long-suffering, who leads the chorus of mercy, we're quoting Apostolic Constitutions, always mindful of salvation of thy creatures. The rolling sea sustains countless forms of life, instructs all thy creatures to shout, how exalted are thy works, O Lord. All things hast thou created in wisdom. The holy seraphim, along with the cherubim, with unwearied voices cry, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. It's the old Hebrew Trisagion, which is in Isaiah 6:3. This is the hymn, Isaiah quotes this hymn too. As all Israel in the church unite their voices, quote, and the powers below heaven sing, as the stars join in this hymn. See, it's the time when when the two worlds come together, we were talking about. They fuse now. In this glorious music and so forth, and all the lights and other effects. The powers below heaven, as the stars join with this hymn of the cosmos to God's bounty and love. See, it's the hymn of redeeming love. Well, he says, Israel, thy earthly church, is now all assembled together in one, it's the assembly, by the powers under heaven, by day and night, with a full heart and a willing spirit, we sing the hymn. The four elements join. The animal creation praises him who gave them the breath of life, and the trees him who caused them to spring up. Whatsoever thing exists by thy word testifies to thy might. Hence it behooves every man to feel in his heart to send up a song to thee through Christ for the sake of all, for thou art kind in thy benefactions and generous in thy compassion. And so we have Alma here asking in the 26th verse, have you experienced a change of heart, and have you felt to sing the song of redeeming love? I would ask you, can you feel so now? And here we're told in the Apostolic Constitutions, it behooves every man to feel in his heart and send up a song, to feel to sing the song of redeeming love. Through Christ for the sake of all, for thou art thy benefaction, generous in thy compassion. And that's the way Alma describes it. My brethren, can you feel to sing the song of redeeming love? I would ask, can you feel so now? And John tells us in Revelations, he's the closest, you see. They sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, and none went to learn the song but 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. You have to be qualified. And so he goes on, and we have the song of redeeming love. And then he says, it's necessary for this, again, notice in the next verse, to be humble, to have your be cleansed and made white, have your garments cleansed and made white. Are you stripped of pride? This is very important, you see. This is the metaphor. Notice the garments, the white garments, signify both humility, because they don't put on any display or anything like that, and purity, because they're white. And are you stripped of pride? That means you put your pride off, you see. As far as that goes, this is another metaphor. Pride is costly apparel. We read a little later on in this chapter, the 53rd and 54th verses, it tells us that's what pride is. So you're stripped of pride here with that garment. Again, the 29th verse, are you stripped of envy, this idea of taking off your old finery? Again, I say unto you, is there any of you that doth make a mock of his brother? This is equality. Mock no one. We say no one is perfect. We like to say that, no one is perfect. That's an easy thing. It lets everybody off the hook. But remember, that means that everybody has something seriously lacking. We're all seriously faulted, you see, when you say no one is perfect. We're all short of it in every case. In fact, that is the theme of that marvelous writing, The Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith. It's been years since they used that in priesthood. I see time is up now. It's been years since they used that in the priesthood, but it's the best manual in the world. That's the theme. Joseph is always hitting the time. How far we are from perfection, and he's as far as anybody else. He says we've got to get that through our thick heads, you see, that we're all seriously defective. That's why we have the gospel. That's why it has to be so strict and so forth. That's what Alma's talking about. If a person is pompous and pretentious, tries to be a ballet dancer or something like that when he can, he deserves mockery. He mocks himself. You don't have to mock him. He'll take care of that. He'll make a fool of himself. You don't have to go into that. And so nobody can make a mock of his brother. Don't do that, whatever you do.